This podcast is brought to you by BMJ Best Practice. BMJ Best Practice offers evidence-based, continually updated, and practical knowledge that will help you make better clinical decisions.
Hello and welcome to this BMJ Best Practice podcast on the menopause. Kieran Walsh is my name. I'm Clinical Director at BMJ. The average age of onset of the menopause in the Western world is 51 years. Hot flushes are the most common symptom. Moderate to severe hot flushes were reported by 24% of women in the Women's Health Initiative, and these symptoms can go on for years. As well as this, treatment of menopausal symptoms can be associated with complications. So it's important that we get the management of this condition right. To give more details about this problem and what we can do about it, we have on the line Dr. Bradford Fenton, obstetrics and gynecology physician who's based in Anchorage. And importantly, Bradford is author of our BMJ Best Practice topic on the menopause. So Bradford, you're welcome. Let's start off by asking, what exactly is the menopause?
Thank you so much for having me here today. So it's important to remember right off the bat that the menopause is a natural part of life. Just like menarche is the onset of menses, regular monthly withdrawal bleedings due to ovulation, menopause is the cessation of this, and well-defined as no menses for 12 months. The current guidelines that really come mostly out of Britain are that there is no testing required for this at all. It's entirely a clinical diagnosis, and no other body really debates that. The only time you really need to get into testing, which is often the first place where you start, is when you have some sort of question or you have a woman who's a little early or a little late. So, for example, I had a patient who is 54, and that's a little late for entering the menopause, and she was telling me she continued to have monthly bleeding, when in fact, she had a big polyp that turned out to be endometrial hyperplasia. And she was solidly in the menopause for several years, but didn't really know it because the standard clinical sign, and also the sign that most women take, just didn't occur. She didn't have cessation of bleeding. She kept bleeding and bleeding and bleeding. And that really leads to the key area of pitfall with the menopause, which is that you must always be vigilant for endometrial hyperplasia, and worse, basically. Most women know exactly what's going on, and generally, they'll show up well before age 51 at an annual exam saying, oh yeah, I have horrible hot flashes, do something about it now. But of course, that's in my office, and we have to remember that the patients that you see in your office are a biased sample of all patients. Not all patients have horrible hot flashes, but ones in my office certainly do, because they've got a problem and they show up for that. Women without a problem generally just don't show up. And that's part of the annual exam, certainly in America and probably around the world, where women will present themselves for an annual exam, but in fact, there's always something else that they really want to talk about. Problems with bleeding are number one on your list of things that have to be diagnosed accurately and precisely. And this occurs also before the onset of menopause. The perimenopause is a time when I see a lot of patients who come in with irregular bleeding, or they're just finally sick of the problems that they've been putting up with for sometimes decades of pain with menses, pain with intercourse, and they just would like it solved now because they realize that their reproductive lifespan is over, and so they want to move on and fix whatever this problem is that's been nagging.
Okay, thank you. That's really helpful. And you mentioned the late menopause, but you also touched on early menopause. What would you define as early? What would concern you?
That's sort of a range of different diagnoses that you really have to be thinking of. Anyone who has cessation of menses before age 51, first of all, needs a pregnancy test, which may seem obvious. But some women are in a lot of denial, and it's really the job of the clinician to overcome that. Anyone under 40 really needs some extra testing to see if they are in the menopause or not, because they have a lot of extra risk for complications related to being in the menopause for an extended period of time. In particular, that means bone loss. Osteoporosis and osteopenia, which is not quite as bad, are problems that do really affect generally much older women. But if you have premature menopause or premature ovarian failure, then you're at much higher risk and you certainly need some sort of anti-resorptive therapy, probably early, but also you'll need some testing and some vigilance on the part of your clinician. Try to make sure that you don't end up with multiple fractures later on in life.
Okay, thank you. And for a woman whose periods stop early, what would be the differential diagnosis for that besides just an early menopause?
Well, pregnancy is number one. It's also like number two and three on the list. But from there, you have to start digging into really the hypothalamic pituitary ovarian axis. And so the standard labs internationally, an FSH is generally considered adequate, follicle stimulating hormone. In America, because I'm old, we all like to see a full panel of FSH, LH, and estradiol levels. In an attempt to try to really time day three, and that more comes down from the assisted reproductive technology people. But those are all pretty good. If they're all lining up together, then you know that for whatever reason, the hypothalamus is screaming and the ovaries have kind of pooped out. Now, if she's not completed her reproduction, this is a big problem for her. And that's a trip to reproductive endocrinology, and that's definitely beyond what I do as a generalist. But that's a significant problem for women who have not completed childbearing. Certainly, in the modern era where many women delay childbearing, that can be a big unhappy surprise.
Okay, thank you. And what about things like anorexia? Do you ever see that as a potential cause?
Certainly, that's part of the female athlete triad. Usually those women are super obvious because they're ultra fit. And you ask them what they do and they go hiking or they're running or they're competitive gymnasts or things like that. And there's really nothing particularly unusual about them. They have the same risks of bone loss and other health problems. They just happen to have managed to throw themselves into a pseudo-menopausal state through aggressive decreases in their body fat percentage. And I do recall it's based on body fat percentage that sort of shuts down the HPA axis. And that's the cause from 14-year-old gymnasts to 24-year-old ultramarathoners. Once your body fat percentage gets below a level where you have the spare 20 to 40,000 calories to carry a pregnancy to term, your body knows that and essentially sort of stutteringly shuts down your ability to ovulate and then reproduce.
Okay, thank you. And what about other things such as thyroid problems or polycystic ovarian syndrome? What might make you think of those?
Those are generally pretty darn obvious. Thyroid disease is, in the lay public, grossly overdiagnosed. In fact, these patients all show up saying, it's my thyroid, and it's never their thyroid. We test it anyway, a TSH, and then if that's abnormal, a repeat TSH, and a free T4 will tell you right away. You can check for goiters, but we really do everything pretty much on the labs. If you really have a strong suspicion, you can send off the antibodies too. In my personal practice, it's quite rare that someone would show up undiagnosed with thyroid disease as the cause of their amenorrhea. Same thing for polycystic ovary syndrome. Those women are generally pretty obvious, and they also come with a fairly clear phenotype and patient history. Well, I've always been irregular, and yeah, I've always had a BMI of 40, and I just never know when my period's going to come. But it does come, and they generally look a lot different than the female athlete triad patients, but not always. I have a couple patients with PCOS who are actually pretty thin, and it's just kind of unusual. And you test them, and you do their ultrasound, and you run all their various androgens, androstenedione, sort of the sine qua non one that's recommended to make sure that you know you've got their diagnosis right. And the treatment is often pretty straightforward, metformin or combination oral contraceptives, sort of depending if they're trying to get pregnant or not.
Okay, thank you. We'll move on to management in a second, but one last query about diagnosis. You mentioned something along the lines of a three-day test or something like
day
that.
Three. Like,
day right. Three. Yep. What's yep. that? Can you tell me?
Oh, it's probably antiquated at this point, but that's just because I'm old. But in order to time your test in the menstrual cycle to laboratory standards, it used to be the case that you would bring women back on day three after the start of their menses so that you could test their estradiol, LH, and FSH all at a standardized time in an effort to predict their ovarian reserve and things like that. In fact, now there's anti-Müllerian hormone and other better tests for that. But a day three labs is a nice way to make sure that you've got your laboratory results at a standardized point in the otherwise fluctuating menstrual cycle, right? Because all the hormones will go up and down depending on where you are in the menstrual cycle. And so if you pick day three, I'm not sure what the history of that is, then you know that you're always picking about the same point where everything should be at least equivalent amongst all the menstrual cycles.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on to management. What's the mainstay of management?
So that really is entirely dependent on the patient. The key element to remember is that if the patient has symptoms, then treatment is generally safe. And this is what all women, well, not all women, but many women come in worried about is, oh my gosh, do I have to start on hormones? And the answer to that question is no, you don't. You can start on hormones and you shouldn't fear them, but there's no reason you have to do anything. It's a natural part of life and you can just kind of cruise through it. That being said, it's really clear that estrogen replacement therapy is option one, two, and three in terms of its effectiveness in controlling hot flashes related to the menopause. Now, there's a bunch of caveats here. The first one is that you really should be treating something, and both the patient and the clinician should be clear on what actual problem it is that they're treating with the medicine. Typically, that's going to be hot flashes and night sweats, and estrogens of almost any kind will make a huge difference for most women, really improving their quality of life overall. It's a very broad improvement, and specifically their sleep. And of course, once you improve sleep, then you improve the rest of somebody's life. So it really does nail that down quite well. The other thing to remember is that systemic estrogens are really not good at delivering a dose to the vagina. And that's sort of the second cadre of women who notice that they've now got burning pain on intercourse because their vaginal epithelium is no longer stratified. It's all thinned out. And so it's very raw and they get very unhappy with that. So you really do need a second estrogen for the vagina if you're treating with hot flashes. Beyond estrogens, your options become a lot less effective. There are some. For hot flashes, typically it's gabapentin.
Okay, thank you. And in what women would estrogens be contraindicated?
So that's definitely clear. Those are women who've had a previous problem with an estrogen or who have an ongoing problem with an estrogen. No one's really got an allergy to an estrogen. I mean, you make it yourself from your own ovaries. But there are certain women who do have thrombophilia. So if you have a pre-existing clotting disorder, some women have terrible cardiovascular disease, quite rare in my general practice, but does occur. And then, of course, anyone who's got an estrogen-dependent tumor usually, but not always, is restricted from using estrogens. And that particular topic has really evolved over the last 10 to 20 years. Now that there is estrogen and progesterone typing of breast cancers, because usually it's breast cancer that we're talking about, those are patients who really know, oh yeah, estrogen-dependent tumors, oh, you shouldn't take it.
Okay, thank you. And other than the ones you've mentioned, what are the main pitfalls in management?
So the key part to always remember is that if the woman has a uterus, she must be getting a progesterone too. The progesterone is required to prevent the uterine lining from turning into endometrial cancer with extended exposure to an unopposed estrogen. This is generally well known, but not always. And I've met a few women who have just been put on an estrogen and they're not and ignored their uterus. I'm like, oh, no. You have to take a progesterone too. It's kind of a problem because it changes your counseling a little bit. The main risks for estrogens are really getting a blood clot. Their association with malignancies is very minimal, whereas progesterones probably do have a risk of breast cancer with them. But you're pretty much stuck with that if you're going to be treating with an estrogen and you've got a uterus. You do have the option to put a leave-in progesterone-containing IUD. And that's generally something that would have been continued over from when the patient was having regular menses. And so they used a leave-in progesterone IUD, they put their last one in at age 45, and they just sort of continue it for a while, and it just sort of cruises them in for up to 8 years of coverage with the progesterone into the menopause. But then at some point, you're going to either need to switch it out or add in a progesterone to the estrogen add-back therapy, basically.
Okay, thank you. Last question about questions generally. What have we missed? Are there any other common questions you get asked about the menopause that we haven't covered already?
So those are really the big topics, and patients are always worried about their complications from estrogens. That topic has definitely evolved from now almost 20 or so years ago, the Women's Health Initiative, which they're now starting to really dig into the details of it. And that's a study that had far-ranging implications because it went from, oh yeah, everybody should take an estrogen, to, oh my gosh, no one should take an estrogen. And really, it's much more nuanced than that. And the current guidelines from all the different places are pretty clear. If you're around the time of the menopause and you have symptoms, it's really perfectly safe to take an estrogen, so you're not miserable. There's a lot of benefits. It does preserve your bone health. It keeps you from just bursting into flame all the time. And your risk of having a complication from the medicine is really quite low. That being said, once you're really past about 57 to 60, you really should reconsider that as a treatment option. But that's not an absolute line in the sand. There are some women, and I have a few, who are solidly in their 60s, and I say, well, did you skip it at any point? And they said, oh yeah, and I had horrible hot flashes, I definitely want a refill of it. And so we go through the counseling again, make sure that she's getting a benefit, and that's really the key part. It has to be regularly reviewed, and most physicians are going to be learning, who are going to be listening to this, do understand that you have to annually review all the medicines of whatever type it is that patients are on. And certainly, these are the top of the list. Fortunately, most women that I have met as patients will in fact go on vacation and they'll forget their pills or they'll do something or other where they don't have their pills with them for a little bit. And I'll say, well, if you skipped it, was there a difference? Could you tell? And generally, the women will be very clear at that. They'll be like, oh yeah, I skipped it and it didn't really make a difference. Or I skipped it and oh, I hated that. I would like to do this again. And you can just use their natural tendency to skip a pill once in a while to guide your management. And they'll tell you right away, which makes it much easier. I have a few patients who are really good at taking pills all the time. And so you can't really use that approach. But you can tell them, take a break. Try it for a week. See how you do. If you don't have any symptoms, well, you probably shouldn't bother to take it. If you do have symptoms, that's okay. Take it. It's not a problem.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bradford. And thanks to all for listening. We hope that this has been helpful, and we hope you'll be able to put what you've learned into action to better diagnose and manage affected patients. If you want to find out more, click click the link in the podcast to sign into BMJ Best Practice and have a look at the content on this and other relevant diseases. Thank you once again.